Half Price Horror.
Hello, and welcome to Half Price Horror, where we get our terror at a discount and pass the savings on to you. Half Price Horror is a spoiler-heavy podcast that takes a deep dive into scary movies curated by the selection at the local Half Price bookstore. I'm your host, John, and today we'll be taking a look at Land of the Dead from 2005. Written and directed by George A. Romero, and if you do the math, you'll very quickly see that this film had a long and troubled road to its eventual production. It was the first new zombie movie from Romero in 20 painful years, and one of only four features he'd directed since Day of the Dead suffered a lukewarm critical and financial reception in 1985. After his relationship with producer Richard Rubenstein and the Laurel Group soured, Romero developed a reputation as a difficult-to-work-with director. He wanted to shoot in his native Pittsburgh, he wanted to film over a lengthy period and allow actors to improvise, and he didn't like dealing with the MPAA, and all of those were increasingly becoming deal-breakers as studios moved their productions to take advantage of lucrative tax breaks and theatrical distribution solidified into the hands of a few powerful companies who refused to screen unrated movies. Romero made Monkey Shines and The Dark Half essentially as a hired gun, and his low-budget feature Bruiser attracted some critical acclaim, but most of the 90s were a lost decade for him, filled with projects like his planned Resident Evil adaptation that never came to fruition. But the Resident Evil video game series brought about a new wave of interest in the zombie subgenre, which was further cemented when 28 Days Later, the Dawn of the Dead remake, the Resident Evil film adaptation, and Shaun of the Dead all came out within a few years of each other and all did big business. Suddenly, everyone wanted to greenlight a zombie movie, and bringing back the original master of undead horror sounded like a great way to make a big splash. The script Romero had been circulating, which was at the time known as Dead Reckoning, attracted attention from both 20th Century Fox and Universal, and they weren't afraid to throw money his way. That money came with strings. This is the first installment of the series shot in Toronto, and it's also the first that has a theatrical rating. But Romero cannily received assurances from Universal that he'd be allowed to release an unrated version on DVD, and that he'd retain the rights to make future installments of the franchise, which 20th Century Fox refused to agree to, and they were finally giving him the budget to film an epic zombie movie the way he wanted to all the way back in 85. And so, Land of the Dead was born. And with that extra money, and the promise of working with a horror legend, came some big names. Admittedly, Simon Baker, who plays protagonist Riley Denbo, was still a few years away from the TV series he'd become inextricably associated with. He was Patrick Jane, the lead actor on long-running CBS series The Mentalist. But he'd already done 67 episodes of The Guardian, the movie Red Planet, and the Academy Award-winning LA Confidential. The Mentalist took up a big chunk of the subsequent decade for him, but he's moved on to films like Here and Now and Blaze. The man Riley sent out to hunt, Cholo, is played by another legendary actor, John Leguizamo. The talented and versatile actor began his career doing stand-up and self-written one-man shows in New York before slowly getting a foothold in Hollywood with appearances in Hangin' with the Homeboys and Whispers in the Dark. His first major roles were a little rocky. He was in the ill-fated Super Mario Bros. Adaptation from 1993, and 1997's extremely cult and very bizarre film, The Pest. I actually love it, but it drove most audiences clean out of the theater. But he also had several classic parts in this era, like Tybalt in Romeo and Juliet, and Chi-Chi in Tu Wong Fu, Thanks for Everything, Julie Newmar. And he absolutely transformed himself to perform the role of the Violator in the 1997 Spawn movie. From there, he just went on from strength to strength, appearing in Summer of Sam and Moulin Rouge and the film under discussion today, as well as a series of voice appearances as Sid in the Ice Age movies. Most recently, he was in the critical darling horror movie The Menu, as well as the Santa Claus meets Die Hard action comedy Violent Night. Really, it's hard to do more than scratch the surface of his amazing career. Likewise, it's hard to really do justice to the topic of Dennis Hopper's life and career in a short biography. Hopper, who plays the villainous Kaufman in this movie, began his career as a character actor, playing heavies in TV shows like Cheyenne and Sugarfoot, and in movies like Gunfight at the OK Corral and Rebel Without a Cause, and Cool Hand Luke, and Bonanza, and The Lieutenant, and The Big Valley, and Hang 'em High, and I mean, he was pretty seriously in demand even in this phase of his career. But everything changed when he teamed up with Peter Fonda to make an independent picture about the rising American counterculture that was in the right place at the right time to become an emblem of the changing face of cinema, Easy Rider. The film was a huge hit, buoyed by the end of the old production code and the modernization of directing techniques, and Hopper's drug-soaked charm endeared him to a younger generation of writers, directors, producers, and actors who felt like they'd been stymied by an ossified studio system. But the constant drug use and heavy drinking, combined with the sudden adulation of an entire cult of personality, went to Hopper's head and made him into a very ugly person. He abused his spouses, he threatened his friends and colleagues with loaded guns, and he made several pictures in the 70s that attempted to recapture the magic of Easy Rider and wound up being disastrous messes. By the mid-70s, his reputation as a violent and unreliable actor left him persona non grata in Hollywood, and even though he had a few notable roles in this period, like his turn as a photojournalist in Apocalypse Now, itself a chaotic and drug-fueled production, it wasn't until he went to rehab in the 80s that people began to employ him again. Even then, his first few post-addiction roles were taken on the cheap, simply to convince people he wasn't going to implode on them again, which is why you see him in things like The Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. But David Lynch's Blue Velvet completed the rehabilitation of his reputation, and by the 90s he was popping up in things like Speed and True Romance, and, yes, Waterworld, but the problems with that film didn't become apparent until production was already well underway. He continued acting all the way up until his death in 2010, with one of his final roles in the infamous An American Carol, a testimony to his conservative politics despite being exactly the kind of Hollywood type that conservative politicians rail against. Honestly, the oddest thing is that he works with Romero in this movie. You cannot find a more liberal director than Romero, and he's got Hopper playing a Brumsfeld analog in what is one of the most explicitly liberal movies I think I've ever seen. Another person whose troubled personal life is difficult to separate from her work is Assia Argento, who appears in this film as femme fatale Slack. Argento is the daughter of Dario Argento and Daria Nicolodi, who I've already talked about extensively in my episode on Suspiria, but her relationship with her famous father was always distant at best due to his obsession with filmmaking and his own personal problems. She took up acting at a young age, by her own account to get attention from the famous director, and appeared in the movies Demons 2 and The Church, which began its life as Demons 3. By the 90s, she'd moved on to acting in American films such as Queen Margot and The Stendhal Syndrome, and it was during this period that she came to the attention of infamous sexual predator Harvey Weinstein. She was one of the many women who came forward during the Me Too movement to accuse Weinstein of assaulting her, and she also claimed that producer Rob Cohen drugged and raped her on the set of the movie Triple X. But as she followed her father's footsteps into directing, actor Jimmy Bennett came forward to accuse Argento herself of sexual assault, claiming that she slept with him when he was still only 17 and below the age of consent. Argento first denied the story, but when evidence came out to corroborate Bennett's claim, she began to instead insist that she didn't realize he was underage and that she considered the encounter consensual. This, combined with the backlash against her for her relationship with celebrity chef Anthony Bourdain and his subsequent death by suicide, has made her drastically reduce her own public profile and demonstrated that when it comes to sexual assault allegations, there's no such thing as a perfect victim. Compared to all that, it's nice to just be able to say that Robert Joy is a Canadian character actor who's had a long and thankfully uneventful career that includes The Dark Half, The Hills Have Eyes, Aliens vs. Predator Requiem, and 165 episodes of CSI New York, and that he's been in a committed relationship with Broadway composer Henry Krieger since 1995. That's the kind of career I want. Famous enough to get plenty of work, and obscure enough to be well out of all the messy business of celebrity culture. And speaking of, actor Eugene Clark, who plays Big Daddy, has been working consistently since the 1970s, doing character roles and day player parts in Canadian shows like Seeing Things and Street Legal, and American shows filmed in Canada like War of the Worlds, The Twilight Zone, and Night Heat. He did several of the tech war movies in the 90s, appearing as Cid Gomez, as well as the 2009 adaptation of the Stephen King story Dolan's Cadillac, but the main thing to remember is that he just keeps working. He's still acting to this day, having just made a guest appearance in Star Trek Strange New Worlds. And as always, this podcast salutes the folks who move from job to job and role to role in an industry that doesn't always reward persistence. And while there are a lot more characters in the story, this is a movie that feels at times like it's got a cast of thousands, let's dig in and mention some of the other names as we go, okay? We open after an old-school Universal logo intended to evoke the classic days of the Universal Monsters, with a series of film clips and radio broadcasts that fill us in on the progress of the zombie apocalypse that's played out over Romero's three previous movies. Originally, the plan was to use archival footage from the Dead films, but prying footage of Dawn and Day away from Rubenstein, who now owned the rights to them, proved prohibitively difficult. To this day, in fact, it's impossible to watch Dawn on any streaming service because of his high asking price. Not that I'm bitter. One thing that's important to mention here, because I do think this is one of the elements that differentiates Romero's zombie movies from others it inspired, is that we finally get definitive on-screen confirmation in one clip of something that was only hinted at before. The dead will reanimate in this universe whether or not they've been bitten. Biting causes an infection that leads to death, but any corpse will get back up unless their brain has been destroyed. I feel like that's important because often zombie narratives are about contamination and infection, the violent intrusion of the other onto the existence of the self leading to the extinguishing of identity. And I really don't think I can stress enough how significant it is that Romero's saying, "We're all zombies in the end." Oh, and this narrative also confirms the infection is worldwide, something else we've long suspected but never overtly seen. I always try to think of the story as more important than the lore, but a certain fanboy part of me loves this kind of world building. The broadcasts end with the announcement that some people have made fortified encampments in the big cities, raiding nearby towns for supplies and equipment, which leads us to the modern day, where a deserted rural town outside of Pittsburgh has become the home of the living dead. Zombies attempt to play instruments in the park's gazebo, a zombie gas station attendant with a patch on his coveralls that says Big Daddy instinctively responds to the accidental chiming of the bell outside his full-service gas station by coming out to pump gas for a car that never arrives. And all of it is observed by Riley and his fellow scout Mike, played by Sean Roberts. You might recognize him from another famous zombie film franchise. He's Wesker in the back half of the Paul W.S. Anderson Resident Evil movies. They're scouting for supplies, while in another part of town, Cholo and his crew are disposing of the bodies of Kaufman's political enemies where no one would dare go looking for them. Riley and Mike are joined by Charlie, whose face looks like it sustained some burns during a previous raid, and the three of them prepare to roll in alongside a whole mob of raiders and take what belongs to the living dead. The group launches fireworks, which Riley calls flowers for the graveyard, and from the confused way Charlie responds to the term, we can already tell he's got some mild cognitive impairment. Incidentally, there are a few slurs related to that that get thrown around in this movie, as well as a few racist terms. They are all used by the villains, but it is a movie that's got some of that material in it, so maybe plan your viewing experience accordingly if you want to watch the film. The fireworks are being launched from a massive, customized APC called Dead Reckoning, driven by a woman nicknamed Pretty Boy, played by Joanne Boland, who's popped up in everything from Mom's Got a Date with a Vampire to The Handmaid's Tale, and absolutely immune to even the most determined zombie assault. As their attack begins, Riley warns Cholo that the zombies in town are beginning to display something akin to consciousness. He witnessed Big Daddy snarling what seemed like instructions to the other undead. But Cholo isn't interested in hearing what he sees as patronizing demands from a man who's on his last night of raiding duty. He's there to have fun and kick zombie ass, and he doesn't see himself as the type to keep doing hazardous jobs like this for little or no reward. It's clear that the two don't like each other very much, but we'll get into that later on in the story. The zombies can't help looking up at the fireworks, rendering them essentially defenseless against the raiding party's assault, even as Big Daddy tries to snap them out of their fugue, and it's fascinating to see that our allegiances have now fully shifted to viewing the undead as proper characters rather than a faceless horde of violent, hungry monsters, as the raiding party kills the animated corpses out of pure sadism while they loot and pillage. It's an evolution that we've been seeing ever since Dawn, but here it bears its full fruit, and it's safe to say even this early into the film that Romero is painting the zombies as an analogy to the working classes. They're just trying to survive, but they're kept distracted by flashy displays of entertainment, even as everything they own is stolen out from under them by the greedy rich. And it's no coincidence that the consciousness-raising Big Daddy is a black man. In fact, every single one of the factions that the as-yet-unseen Kaufman is playing against each other is led by a member of a different ethnic group, and I don't think that's accidental. This is a highly political movie, even by the standards of what's come before it in the series. The raid goes south when the fireworks launcher jams, though, and Riley orders the group to bug out with whatever supplies they can while Dead Reckoning lurches into action with its more potent and devastating weapons. But Cholo decides to make a raid on a liquor store anyway, knowing that booze is highly valuable on the black market back in the city, and while he's able to dispatch a zombie that attacks him with his signature spear gun, supposedly this is Bub, but I don't see it myself, Mike gets bitten on the wrist by another zombie he doesn't see. He dies by suicide shortly after Riley arrives, and the look exchanged between Riley and Cholo speaks volumes about the relationship between the two men. They leave, not realizing that Big Daddy is watching them go with understanding in his undead eyes. He knows which way they headed, and he's not the forgiving type. A horde of zombies follows him as he marches off to seek his revenge. Back in the city, which is never named, but is pretty clearly the Three Rivers district of Pittsburgh, Charlie and Riley commiserate over Mike's death while they unload supplies for Fiddler's Green, a luxury high-rise in the center of the fortified city where the last of the world's elite live in comfort and security despite the chaos around them. Ironically, it's named after a myth of a glorious afterlife that awaits sailors after their years at sea, so Romero's saying that all of the people who live there are just as dead in their own way as the zombies outside. As they unload, Cholo and Riley have it out over Mike's death, with Cholo telling Riley that his father lived an altruistic life and never gained anything from it, so he's gonna look out for number one and buy a place in Fiddler's Green. Riley knows that Cholo's never going to be able to join the elite, no matter how many dirty jobs and how much contraband he brings in for them. He's a tool to be used and discarded, strung along with promises of wealth that will never actually materialize. Again, this is an intensely political movie, and while Big Daddy is there to represent the futility of consciousness raising in the face of systematic capitalist oppression, Cholo exists to demonstrate the fate of those who try to undermine working class solidarity in order to advance themselves. Riley, in turn, is emblematic of working-class apathy in the face of what seems like an impossible struggle, but we'll get to that. Cholo brings the champagne and cigars he found to Fiddler's Green, and we see the luxury and opulence of the very rich and very white elite contrasted with the bleak and brutal life of the people in the city outside. Everyone here is living a life of grim necessity, even though they've managed an effective barricade. With the Allegheny and Monongahela rivers on two sides, the only way for zombies to attack is through a region called the Throat that's protected by snipers and electric fences. Rather than leave a crowd of zombies to batter at their defenses, they're quick to kill anything approaching, and most of the undead have by this point given up on the fortified town. Not everyone is satisfied by the current state of affairs, though. A rabble-rouser named Mulligan, played by Bruce McPhee with a beautiful Irish accent, reminds a crowd that Kaufman didn't build Fiddler's Green, he just took it over, which feels remarkably relevant now in an age where Elon Musk can literally buy the rights to call himself the founder of Tesla, even though it existed years before he got involved with the company. But Mulligan's attempts to recruit Riley run hard into his determination to opt out of the system and find somewhere outside of the city where he won't be bothered by the living or the dead, and everyone else is too busy trying to scrape by to imagine a better world. This was intended to be a commentary on 2005 and the second Bush administration, but it's only gotten more and more cogent as the years have gone by and Trump has shown us just how much worse things can get. When he arrives at Kaufman's quarters, Cholo's greeted by Knip, Kaufman's manservant, played with an almost too on-the-nose racism by Gene Mack. He's dressed like a butler straight out of the 1930s, radiating the know-your-place racism of an era where nobody needed to hide their prejudices. And Cholo discovers that he's still got a little more dirty work to do when it turns out that Kaufman's neighbor has died by suicide and his reanimated corpse needs to be taken care of before it can escape the noose and bring chaos to the regimented order of Fiddler's Green. Cholo does what he has to do, battering the undead man to death with a piece of decorative art, but not before the man's son gets bitten as well and has to be killed too. Riley, meanwhile, discovers that the car he bought to drive out into the wilderness and find a new life for himself has been stolen, and he goes to an underground dive to get it back. The place is wild, filled with the kind of licentious pleasures you only find among people who don't value their lives very much anymore, and some people are even getting their pictures taken with chained-up zombies played by none other than Simon Pegg and Edgar Wright. They apparently showed Romero their movie Shaun of the Dead as an endeavor to gain his blessing for the project, and he loved it so much he gave them cameos in this movie. Well, Riley speaks with a man named Chihuahua, played by famous little person Phil Fondacaro. He was in Bordello of Blood, Doll Man vs. Demonic Toys, Willow, Troll, Return of the Jedi, and most memorably to me in the strange cult film American Drive-In, where he plays a disgruntled actor firing his agent for not even being able to get him a part in Return of the Jedi. Charlie notices that the bookie Roach, played by Earl Pastco, is taking a lot of bets over a pair of zombies in a sandpit and which one of them can take the lion's share of a piece of prey dropped into the arena. The prey turns out to be a human woman, Slack, and it's a sign of just how debauched the crowd has become that they don't show any sympathy for this woman who's literally being fed to the living dead. She fights off the zombies fairly effectively, but given that they don't get tired and she doesn't have a weapon, her options are limited. Riley returns from threatening Chihuahua to discover the match in progress, though, and shows his true decency by shooting both zombies in the head and saving Slack's life. That causes a shootout, with Charlie clipping Chihuahua in the bulletproof vest and Slack taking a bullet that was meant for Riley, but she's only injured and Charlie shows off the skill that makes him such a useful member of the team by blowing Chihuahua's brains out with a carbine rifle. This particular type of rifle is famous for being lethally accurate even though it has very little stopping power, which makes it perfect for a sniper who doesn't care about anything but getting headshots. The crowd panics and flees, and Slack, Charlie, and Riley are all arrested for the death of Chihuahua and the subsequent chaos. In their cells, Slack explains that Kaufman had her thrown to the zombies for helping Mulligan, using his connections with the underworld to once again get other people to do his dirty work and make a hefty profit in the process. But Riley says he's tired of hearing everybody's sob stories, he's tired of being dragged down into other people's problems, and he just wants to go north to Canada where there's nobody to bother him, living or dead. Even when Mulligan gets arrested as well, it doesn't significantly stir his apathy. Big Daddy, meanwhile, has led his people to within sight of the city and is teaching them how to break down wooden barricades using meat cleavers. Let's just put a pin in that for later, shall we? Cholo finally speaks to Kaufman, offering up his champagne and cigars as tribute before bringing up the subject of buying his way into Fiddler's Green with the dirty money he's earned from doing unethical errands for Kaufman. But Kaufman politely explains that there's a very long waiting list and a board of directors he has to answer to. When Cholo reminds Kaufman that he knows where all the bodies are buried, literally as well as figuratively, Kaufman simply summons security and has him escorted out. He quietly mentions that he doesn't need Cholo anymore, and that's really all he needs to say for the guard to quietly pull a pistol on him as they head down the stairs. It turns out that violence and loyalty are two skills that are very much higher in supply than demand. But Cholo saw it coming, and he disarms the guard and kills him, determined to make Kaufman pay for his betrayals. He gathers his crew and steals Dead Reckoning while the city's defenders are distracted by Big Daddy and his zombies, and doesn't even bother to warn anyone that there's a serious threat to the fortifications. The undead storm the barricades and eat the guardians of the bridge, while Cholo calls Kaufman on the radio and tells him that he wants $5 million, or he'll use Dead Reckoning's missile launchers to blow Fiddler's Green to bits. But in a very 2005 line, Kaufman says, "We don't negotiate with terrorists," and hauls Riley out of jail to make a deal with him. Riley designed and built Dead Reckoning, and he knows the beast's secrets. If he can retrieve the APC and prevent the destruction of Fiddler's Green, Kaufman will return his car and allow him to leave town. Because, of course, Kaufman ordered the theft. The man who made Dead Reckoning was far too valuable to let out of his sight. Chola leaves his lieutenant Mouse, played by Maxwell McCabe Locos, to watch at the ransom drop while he moves Dead Reckoning to a safe location. It's the shittiest and most dangerous of jobs, and Mouse is quick to find a hiding place to keep him out of sight of any zombies in the area. Slack, meanwhile, isn't exactly thrilled to be helping Kaufman, but Riley points out that a lot of people stand to get hurt if Cholo shells Fiddler's Green with missiles. She decides to trust him, helped more than a little by her discovery while alone with Charlie, that Riley's the reason he's still alive after the fire that burned him, and together the group gets equipped from the fight. My favorite line after Charlie's offered his submachine gun that fires 14 rounds a second, I don't normally need that many. It's so wonderfully self-deprecating. Kaufman sends three of his own people along with them, Manolete, played by Sasha Ruiz, Motown, played by Krista Bridges, and Pillsbury, an absolute mountain of a man, played by Nicaraguan actor Pedro Miguel Arce, as the secret star of this movie. This is probably his signature role, although he worked regularly throughout the 2000s and 2010s playing thugs and heavies due to his physique and experience as a bouncer and martial artist, and he sadly passed away in 2022. The six of them go looking for transport and discover the aftermath of Big Daddy's attack. They warn Kaufman that the zombies are amassing on the edge of the river, but he doesn't seem concerned about anything but retrieving his vehicle and the symbol of his power. But the people caught out there are very concerned, and they hotwire a car to get away from the danger zone and get after Dead Reckoning. This is the moment that absolutely endeared me to Arce. He's giving Motown instructions on how to hotwire the car, and she says, "What the fuck does a Samoan know about hotwiring a fucking car?" He replies, "50,000 cars stolen in Samoa every year." And when she points out that's pretty small potatoes compared to her hometown of Detroit, he says, "Detroit's got 50 million cars. Samoa, 50,000. Everyone stolen." It's such wonderful deadpan delivery that the first time I saw this back in the theater on its original release, my only goal from that moment on was to see this man surviving the rest of the movie. Charlie shows off his marksmanship skills by shooting 2 inches to the right of Slack's ear to kill a zombie, while Riley and Manolete discover the hard way that pretty much everyone defending the barricade is dead or undead. They collect ammo, and thank goodness this is the director's cut, because we don't get the CGI fog that obscured the gory scenes of zombies feeding that marred the theatrical version. This came out smack dab in the middle of the golden age of the unrated director's cut DVD, because theaters were finally enforcing age restrictions on ticket sales, and so the lucrative business of selling horror to people too young to watch it had to move to a different point in the distribution chain. Personally, I'm thrilled, because in a lot of cases it meant we could finally see the movies the way the filmmakers made it, instead of hearing about clips that were improperly stored and lost to the ages, like in the 80s. Slack returns Charlie's favor by shooting a zombie just behind him, although she grazes him with the bullet. "That hurt. I didn't hurt you," he cries out. And Motown finally gets the car started as the others return with the ammo. But in one of the more memorable moments, Manolete is bitten by a zombie whose head hangs behind him attached only by a thin strip of flesh, giving it the appearance of being decapitated right until it lunges and the head flips forward to chomp down on his arm. And everyone in the car knows the bite is going to become infected and lethal. Riley mentions that his little brother took less than an hour to turn before he died and Riley had to shoot him, and it's clear that his physical and psychological survival depends on compartmentalizing his trauma in ways that a better world would allow him to unpack someday. Slack feels the same way and shoots Manolete in the head without even a token protest from the others. My one complaint about this scene, boy do the zombies in this movie have some nice strong jaw muscles. It's hard to bite even through unprotected flesh, but Manolete collects a chomp that goes straight through what looks to be some sort of tactical body armor. Then again, if I started pointing out how easy it is to protect yourself from regular old teeth and fingernails, I'd probably wind up invalidating 90% of the zombie apocalypse stories out there, so let's just not. Back in Fiddler's Green, Kaufman explains to his fellow rich white men that even if Cholo makes good on his threat, he's already established alternative outposts for them to go to. As with COVID and a host of other crises, the rich simply have the resources to absorb catastrophes that are devastating to ordinary people like you and me. Romero had a pretty bleak outlook on civilization, but unfortunately it feels like time just keeps proving him more and more correct. Riley follows a tracking device hidden in Dead Reckoning, but he takes a moment to make it clear to Motown and Pillsbury that whatever they thought their jobs were, their new job is to help him steal the APC, and if they think they can double-cross him on Kaufman's behalf, they can instead just get out and walk. Motown tries to deny that she was even thinking about screwing him over, but she's not a very good liar, and Riley reiterates the new terms. Dead Reckoning isn't going to be used against the city, but it's not going to be used to prop up the old regime anymore. Kaufman, predictably, refuses to deliver the ransom. Mouse, who's been waiting for the drop, gets murdered by a pack of zombie clowns shortly after radioing in to let Cholo know he's got to call his old boss's bluff. And on the edge of the river, Big Daddy finally realizes something that takes a very smart zombie indeed to figure out. He doesn't need to breathe. He leads the others into the water and they begin to walk along the river bottom to the city and Fiddler's Green. They emerge in a chilling shot homage directly from 1962's Carnival of Souls and Herc Harvey's brilliantly influential direction, with the city right in front of them and totally undefended. It's a moment that's both beautiful and dreadful at the same time. Kaufman, seeing the writing on the wall, decides to jump ship. He packs up a ton of cash, while down in the city below, the first civilians begin to meet their fate at the hands of the zombies. The very first victims we see are a lesbian couple, which might well be a commentary on how the queer community is always underserved and underprotected when it comes to existential crises. Or it could just be a little pointless titillation. Hard to tell in this era. Riley and his group beat the ponderous APC to its destination with their more maneuverable car, and Riley goes to try to talk some sense into Cholo. Motown tries to turn Charlie and Slack against him while he's gone, but Pillsbury's fully switched sides now and knocks her right the fuck out before she can do anything too vile. Because again, Pillsbury is the secret protagonist of this movie and you can't convince me otherwise. Charlie goes running off to help Riley, and the two of them meet up with their old comrades in arms to have a friendly chat. Cholo is willing to talk, but he has no intention of changing any of his actual plans. He's still going to fire on the city, and he's kind of amused that Riley's the one doing Kaufman's dirty work now while he's out in Dead Reckoning trying to bring down the whole corrupt system. But Riley keeps trying to get through to him, reminding him that a lot of innocent people are going to die if he uses missiles on the city. He uses a failsafe remote to shut the vehicle down, and when Cholo tries to use force to get him to switch it back on, he's shot by a recovered Motown shortly before she's bitten right in the face by a zombie she didn't see sneaking up on her. Charlie disarms the rest of Cholo's crew, neutralizing the threat to the city and leaving Cholo badly wounded. Riley calls in the all-clear to Kaufman, who's a little disconcerted by the timing of it all because he just finished killing a subordinate who discovered him looting the treasury and leaving. But that's when it becomes clear just how badly things are going in the city at the hands of the zombies, and while Riley and the others decide to go back in Dead Reckoning to see if they can help, Kaufman decides that fleeing might be a good idea after all. Down in the streets, chaos reigns, with zombies coming from as far away as Monroeville to help hunt the living. And one of them seems to have mastered the use of the machete as a weapon. Yes, that is Tom Savini, reprising his role as Blades from 1978's Dawn of the Dead, and this time fighting for the other side. Cholo and his lieutenant Foxy, played by Tony Nappo, take off in Riley's car, hoping to make their way to an outpost in Cleveland, but Cholo gets bitten on the hand. With nothing left to live for, he decides to go back to the city to get revenge on Kaufman and, in his words, see how the other half lives. Symbolically, it's the moment where he rediscovers his working-class roots and joins the revolution already in progress. We get a ton more of the gore that Romero is known for, as the city and its defenders fall one by one to Big Daddy and his zombies. And I'll confess, I haven't seen this movie since it came out in the theaters, so getting to see all of the unexpurgated gore was really kind of a revelation, and it makes the movie so much better. Then, as you knew they eventually would, the zombies go after Fiddler's Green and the rot at the heart of the capitalist structure. This is the most straight-up communist horror movie ever, and you know what? I'm kinda here for it. The carnage against the wealthy and powerful is wonderfully cathartic, with men in suits dragged down and one woman who wears an ironic Eat the Rich t-shirt either getting an extra layer of irony added onto the slogan or all of it stripped away, as she is, in fact, a rich person who's eaten. Riley brings Dead Reckoning back to the city over a lowered drawbridge after a tense set piece where he has to get out to bring it down and is nearly caught by a mob of zombies. He sends up some fireworks to distract the undead, but the revolution is here and they're not going to be denied from their objective anymore. Even Kaufman, who thinks he can escape through an underground garage, discovers he's not immune to consequences when Big Daddy shatters the windshield of his private car and pours gasoline directly into it before leaving him to stand near a pool of flammable liquid. Kaufman's forced to flee on foot with his ill-gotten gains, but Cholo shows up as a zombie to exact his revenge, something technically denied him by a firebomb rolled into the puddle of gas by Big Daddy. Both Kaufman and Cholo are destroyed by the explosion. Riley arrives to blow the electric fences at the throat and allow the human survivors to escape, but he's too late. The whole crowd has been devoured by the living dead. Charlie and Pretty Boy use the APC's weapons to blow the zombies to bits in what they think is a final act of mercy for the Lost City, but they discover to their surprise and delight that Mulligan managed to lead a group of survivors to safety, and they're now able to make the city into the kind of egalitarian paradise they always wanted it to be. As Riley and his crew load up Dead Reckoning, headed for Canada and freedom, he sees Big Daddy, and the two of them exchange a meaningful look. They've come to an understanding, an accommodation between the living and the now sentient dead that could herald the end of the old antagonism and the beginning of a new order of things, and just possibly a tiny sliver of hope for the future as well. It's about the most optimistic Romero ever gets. If we all work together and murder the rich en masse, the world might just become a better place. As messages go in a horror movie, I have to say, I've heard worse. And will I hang on to this movie? Well, let's just qualify this one as yes with a but. I do love the film. It's got a lot of Romero's signature blend of humor and horror, and it's got a scope and an ambition he was never able to realize before, and sadly won't ever be able to realize again. Land just about broke even, but it wasn't the kind of hit that allowed him to make another film this epic and visually spectacular. But the copy I found is full screen, and I am something of a purist about that. So the second I find a widescreen version, I'm ditching this in favor of something that shows the entire screen. Until that day, though, it's staying on my shelf. And if you want to talk about communist revolutions, the rumored appearance of Bub in this film, or about anything else that came up on this podcast, you can find me on Twitter as @halfhorror, and on Tumblr, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd as @halfpricehorror. My watch list on Letterboxd contains everything I plan to tackle in future episodes. If there's something you'd like to hear about, let me know. You can also support the show at patreon.com/halfpricehorror, and you can rate and review me on Apple Podcasts and anywhere else this podcast is found. And next time on Half Price Horror, I know I try to come up with my own particular spin on the upcoming movie announcement I do at the end of every episode, but sometimes there's just no substitute for the slogan on the poster. So for the next movie, an exploitation horror flick from 1974, I'll just say there's only one thing wrong with the Davis baby. It's alive. See you then.